We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. So, diving into this week's news, and Seattle teachers have been on strike for the better part of this week.
Yeah, the first day of school was set for this past Wednesday, the 7th, but the first day came and went with no school because the Seattle School District and the Seattle Education Association are still pretty far apart on their contract negotiations for a new teacher's contract. Last week, the Seattle Education Association asked the membership to vote on a strike, and the members overwhelmingly voted to allow the association to call a strike if they had not reached an agreement with the school district. There was 75% turnout, and about 95% of the voting membership voted to strike. So pretty overwhelming there. Negotiations are continuing through this weekend in the hopes that a new contract can be finished soon enough to get teachers into the classroom next week at the earliest. Now, teachers are asking for higher pay, of course, and reasonable workloads and class sizes, including adding a student-to-teacher calculation to the new contract, which, of course, the school district opposes. The school district is proposing language that would allow the district to evaluate the needs of students, so on a classroom-by-classroom basis. In other words, they want the freedom to be able to adjust class sizes on the fly, and teachers are adamantly opposed to that proposal. In particular, the Seattle Education Association is saying that they want higher wages for paraprofessionals and instructional assistants who in Seattle make less than $20 per hour, some of them as low as about just a little over $19 per hour, versus in neighboring school districts in King County that who pay paraprofessionals and instructional assistants $22 to $27 per hour. And remember that it's way more expensive to try to live in Seattle if you're making under $20 an hour than if you're just trying to live, say, in Renton or areas north of Seattle. The teachers are also asking the district to avoid making any cuts to special education and multilingual education, and to add more staff so that special ed and multilingual students can spend more time in general classrooms where they do better and they learn faster. And what they're proposing is that each classroom that has a mix of students, including special ed and multilingual students, have both a regular teacher and a special education or an ESL teacher teaching alongside with the regular teacher, and that studies have shown that that setup actually helps all the students in the classroom learn better and learn faster. So it isn't just only for the benefit of a small number of special education or multilingual students to have this, that actually having more than one teacher in a classroom helps all of the students to learn better. And it's probably because one teacher can take the lead while the other can assist if a student is having questions or falling behind. And that the two probably help and reinforce each other when they're teaching a subject. Oh, yeah. In addition, the Seattle Education Association wants ESL, or English as a Second Language, programs added to more schools so that kids can go to their neighborhood schools instead of having to bus long distances far away from home every day to school and back from school. This can allow kids not just to be with their friends who they know in their neighborhood. It also allows them more time outside of school to study rather than be sitting on a bus, okay, or commuting. So those are the things that the two sides are far apart on, and hopefully they will reach some kind of agreement sooner rather than the strike dragging on.
Meanwhile, the Seattle School District has a distinct advantage of being able to directly reach out to parents and families that the SEA doesn't necessarily have.
Yeah, although I think a lot of parents communicate with and know who their kids' teachers are. And of course you can always, the SEA has a website and you can always, go down and visit the picket lines because there have been picket lines at schools. You can go down there, talk to the teachers, get a flyer, hear about the contract, hear what their concerns are. Mm-hmm. And of course parents will be hearing from the school district. You know, as you said, they have a pretty good bullhorn out to parents about what the school district wants. So.
All right. Moving on. It appears that, Mayor Bruce Harrell has, chosen some police chief finalists.
Harrell said that, he was going to, by the end of fall, pick a new police chief and, a new person to head the Office of Police Accountability, and a new person to replace Andrew Meyerberg as his public safety czar in his cabinet, right? This week, he announced three finalists in his search for a new permanent police chief. The last time we had a permanent police chief was Carmen Best, who resigned back in 2020. And Mayor Durkin promptly said that she would not do a search for a new police chief. And since she was not running for re-election, she would let the next mayor do that. So the interim chief, Adrian Diaz, stepped up and has been filling that role ever since. Now, yeah, Diaz
is part of her comprehensive plan to not do her job for the last year and a half.
Yeah, and actually that was not unusual. She had a lot of acting directors of various city departments that she didn't formally present them to the city council for the city council to vote on and accept as the permanent head for any department, which is a really dysfunctional way to run government.
Where have I heard that tactic before?
Mm-hmm, yes, Donald. That was a prime tactic of Donald Trump's. Now, Adrian Diaz is one of the three candidates that Harrell is putting forward now. Harrell has praised him in the past, so that's really no surprise. And Bruce Harrell had encouraged Diaz to apply for this position. Of course, Diaz has come under fire recently for diverting officers from investigating violent crimes like sexual assault in order to fully staff up Mayor Bruce Harrell's homeless encampment sweeps and to do other things like direct traffic and oversee sporting events.
I would think that would endear him to Bruce Harrell.
Yeah, it endears him to Bruce Harrell, but not necessarily to about 90% of the Seattle population who would prefer that the police. I think we envision investigating violent crimes as a core duty of a police officer, not something that you just do if you have some spare time. Okay. Now, the second candidate that Harrell announced is Eric Greening, who, like Diaz, has served as assistant chief of the Collaborative Policing Bureau, which means his most recent work has been doing a whole lot of PR work, which is what the Collaborative Policing Bureau does. Greening took over that job after interim chief Diaz decided to demote Steve Herjack. Herjack is the officer that Diaz, I don't know if you remember this, he is the officer that Diaz blamed for the police riots during the early days of the George Floyd protests in the summer of 2020. And Herjack filed a lawsuit against the city of Seattle claiming that the department, there were wider failures in the department that led to the outsized and too violent police response to largely peaceful protesters in the summer of 2020, and that Diaz and the police management and the city of Seattle were discriminating against him by demoting him and blaming him solely for that problem. And I think that lawsuit is still ongoing. Greening is the person who stepped up and took over Herjack's job when Herjack was demoted. Now, prior to that, Greening was assistant chief of the Special Operations Bureau. And Special Operations sounds kind of like a cool name, and the very first thing you think of is like covert operations, right?
No, I was thinking SWAT teams, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
No, SWAT teams is not in the Special Operations Bureau that I know of. It contains things like traffic enforcement, parking enforcement, and something called criminal intelligence. But I want to point out that that's not criminal investigations. Criminal investigations is a whole different bureau that houses violent crimes, special victims, narcotics, and real criminal investigations. I'm not really clear on what criminal intelligence is, but my guess is it might cover something like interfacing with the public and taking public complaints. Okay, so that was Greening. So that's Greening's most recent experience. To me, that kind of brings up a vision of somebody who's really, really good at really kind of a slick PR type person who's really, really good at very social and really, really good at interfacing with the public, but maybe not as knowledgeable as he should be on kind of what the public envisions as the core duties of a police department or of a police officer. And it also, to my mind, brings up this idea that both he and Diaz are pretty deeply embedded in the current culture at SPD, right? If you're going to be doing this job where you're an interface between the public and the police department, you're doing a whole lot of time explaining what the department is about and covering up for shortcomings, probably. Right. Yeah. So that's something that has come up in the discussions between the city and the police monitor and the court and the judge that's overseeing the police accountability process here in Seattle, is that there's a culture at SPD that needs to change and needs to be more responsive to the public and to not be using excessive force.
You know, at this point, I think we can put the reform process for SPD in the same general category as the 10-year plan to end homelessness.
Yeah. And the city, of course, Mayor Harrell's attitude is that, well, we should have gotten out from under this a long time ago. That's the same attitude that we're seeing at the Seattle Police Department. You know, the city council passed a comprehensive bill to reform the police department, but there are large portions of it that have not gone into effect because the police unions have continually and repeatedly negotiated new contracts with the city of Seattle, particularly the mayor's office, that don't implement aspects of the police reform law. And that's why we're still under the court supervision, right? Now, the third candidate that Mayor Bruce Harrell proposed is not a longtime member of the Seattle Police Department. His name is Kevin Hall. He's the assistant chief of the Tucson, Arizona Police Department, or an assistant chief. Hall has worked for the Tucson PD for about 30 years, serving in a number of different positions. One thing that I thought was kind of interesting is that he helped implement a diversion program for Tucson in 2018, which sends people who are charged with nonviolent crimes to substance abuse programs in lieu of jail time. And that program has shown some success in getting folks out of the criminal justice system when they have a substance abuse problem. In addition, he was part of a team that worked to change the culture at the Tucson Police Department and the county attorney's office to accept and actively use the diversion program. And that looks – it's one I hesitate to say small, but one part of – just one part of his career that kind of jumped out to me And I found that quite interesting and much more promising than anything I was able to find about Greening or Diaz. But, you know, like I said, Mayor Harrell doesn't see anything wrong with the current Seattle Police Department culture. So I think he's leaning towards Diaz, and Diaz is the front runner here. Now, there were supposed to be public forums where the mayor's office could gather public feedback from stakeholders on these different candidates. Instead, from my understanding, is that there will just be one publicly broadcasted Q&A session on September 15th. Probably really, really similar to the staged, quote unquote, interviews that were done with the candidates for the head of the Office of Police Accountability. In other words, you know, give the candidates the questions ahead of time and let them do their prepared speeches. Yeah, exactly. There was also mention of a series of stakeholder interviews, but those appear to not be public meetings. And I'm guessing that's more of meetings with some of Mayor Harrell's handpicked buddies to meet
Amazon.
To meet the candidates, shake hands, and then give the mayor some feedback. So I think the opportunity to evaluate these candidates by the public is actually going to be very minimal. Now, there's no actual requirement in city law that the public weigh in on the candidates. It's really the mayor's decision, but it would be nice, particularly for something as big and important as the Seattle chief of the Seattle Police Department, that the public get a first look and be able to weigh in. But as it's happening, we're actually getting a last look after the mayor's probably pretty much made up his mind.
And bear in mind that the whole process that resulted in the hiring of Carmen Best was a public blowback after the originally named finalists were deemed as inadequate, and community leaders pushed for Carmen Best to be included in the finalists, and she was subsequently hired.
Mm-hmm. You know, nowhere along the line up to this point has anyone been able to ask any of the candidates, what's your vision for police accountability or reform at the police department? You know, it just has not happened. And here we are, we're down to the wire. Harrell has said he wants to make the decision by the end of the month. You know, that's, what, 3 weeks away?
Yeah.
And the only time we'll get a real look at these candidates is the middle of next week.
And Harrell, of course, made those that we talked about, made the comments a couple of weeks back when he was doing tours of SPD and making speeches, and said some, according to the transcripts, some pretty amazing things there. And his when he was questioned about them a couple of days later in a press conference, he basically said, well, I make 5-6 speeches a week. I can't possibly remember everything I say in those. It's like,
I believe that. And anybody who watched him on the campaign trail would understand that.
Yeah, but and my response is, well, you have associates from your administration there with you. Have you thought about asking them perhaps what you said at a specific location?
Or maybe keeping your notes, which should be part of the public records
exactly.
of your office. You know, dig up your notes.
What are notes?
Recording devices that you can take with you as well. So, you know.
Well, that's just that was my feeling about Harrell. As he speaks off the cuff, he doesn't always make a lot of sense. A lot of what he says is word salad, and he doesn't care very much about what the impact is of what he says. So I really believe that he could have made those speeches, just spouted a whole lot of word salad with some very interesting statements in there that were revealing of how he feels about public safety in Seattle. And then just, you know, walked away with, you know, wow, that was fun to get that off my chest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like doing these speeches.
I think they really liked me.
Yeah, yeah. These are my best buddies. This was a good thing.
Yeah.
UW Regents voted this week to
Yeah. The UW Regents, that's the group of mostly wealthy people who run the university and in particular decide how the university's endowment is invested. They voted this week to divest the university's investments from fossil fuel companies. And of course, my first response was, what? You're not already doing that?
Well, I mean, students have been pressing for that for at least a decade.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, it took them long enough, you know. But when I read a little deeper, it's going to take them 5 years to get it done. So they voted to divest the endowment from fossil fuel companies by the year 2027. And they also voted to invest 2.5% of the university's portfolio in, quote unquote, climate solutions companies. Right. Although they didn't, I didn't see where they actually defined that. And of course, they're committing to net zero emissions in the portfolio, but it's not until 2050, which is almost 30 years from now. I remember just a couple of years ago, student activists were collecting signatures on a petition to, try to get the endowment try to get the Board of Regents to actually act on divesting the endowment. What I thought was kind of interesting was, even though students have been protesting and have been petitioning, and they actually submitted a formal petition through a new process that the Board of Regents created back in 2015, formally requesting the regents to act and act as soon as possible, it's taken them a long, long time to actually respond. But even responding to that, the new policy has wording in there that says it can be revoked at any time because it contains language that allows the regents to reevaluate how their investments are doing, including the climate solutions. The investments in climate solutions companies. So in other words, it'll prioritize the rate of return that the university can get on its investments over the actual existence of the human race and the livability of the planet. And I saw that and I was just kind of laughing, like, okay, there you go. That's capitalism in a nutshell. It's like rate of return trumps everything, including the survivability of the planet. Of the human race and the livability of the planet. So I thought that was quite interesting. And of course, it was presented in local media as, look, even the UW Board of Regents, they're doing something great. They're divesting from fossil fuels. I was like, what? They didn't do that. They haven't done that yet. They're just doing it now. And of course, the details are, slowly and possibly possibly we'll change our mind.
My memory, of course, like everyone's, is getting a little fuzzier as I get older, but I thought the Regents had previously dealt with, in response to major, student-led organizational pushback against using apparel companies for UW products that involved sweatshop labor. Mm-hmm. And it just seems kind of funny now that the whole planet has officially turned into a giant sweatshop that they aren't seeing the connection there.
Yeah.
I think you're taking that term sweatshop a little too literally.
Well, I don't know. I think you can take it figuratively or literally.
Even with the vote this week, there were members of the Board of Regents who were just like, I don't understand why we're doing this. You know, our job is to make sure that the university gets the highest rate of return it possibly can, you know, and these considerations shouldn't matter. You know, so there are plenty of folks, within the wealthy community of the world, not just here in Seattle, who just don't see the survivability of the planet, you know, the livability of the planet as something that they need to be concerned about. The only thing that they care about is their short-term interest. And that is something that is a feature of capitalism.
Right. Well, there's
profits trump everything.
There's a critical difference, which is that the University of Washington is a public institution. and therefore, at least theoretically, committed to the public good. Now, I'll pause for the laugh track that you can insert here, Mike, but that should at least in theory be a consideration in terms of where the UW invests its money.
Oh yeah, and that's the student's point, right? Is that it's a public university and it shouldn't be using its money for things that harm the public, right? But there are plenty of companies out there that exist for profit and that pay a great rate of return. And as I said, the Board of Regents is largely a group of wealthy folks who are primarily tasked, at least in their own minds, with getting a high rate of return on the UW's investments. So,
right.
You know, their guiding principle is the long-term survival of the university's endowment, not even necessarily the university itself or the students or the human population, just the university's endowment. You know, and it sets up this ridiculous situation where people are thinking about how long will the money last when the survival of the human race may not last that long. You know, as if the money exists separate from humanity, right? The numbers kind of exist on their own.
Yeah, well, we just transfer it to the bank on Mars. Okay.
Right,
the first national bank of Mars.
Or the money will belong to AI because that's all that will exist after we're gone, right? Are the machines.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Moving on. Washington's state of emergency is over?
Yeah, Governor Inslee this week, he announced the upcoming end to his COVID emergency declaration. So if you remember back in February of 2020, when Washington state was the front line in the COVID pandemic, Governor Jay Inslee announced a state of emergency. And that state of emergency announcement then allowed him to put in other policies that led to the COVID lockdown. And some of those policies included things like closing schools, forcing some businesses to close, like many restaurants, for example, banning large gatherings, putting a mask mandate into place, and mandating vaccinations for public employees. This week, Governor Inslee announced that the state of emergency will end on October 31st. Businesses will still be able to mandate masks and or vaccinations, but they won't be required to. And some health programs will still be in place, like vaccination clinics, the state's contact tracing program, the state's COVID dashboard, and a state Department of Health requirement that everyone wear face masks in healthcare facilities and in long-term care facilities. So, for example, you'll still have to wear a mask at the doctor's office or if you go to visit grandma in her long-term care facility. And Governor Inslee is keeping the vaccination requirement for employees of state agencies in place. Now, remember, this is not happening yet. It's set to happen on October 31st. So there's still about 7 weeks to go. And I should say there are plenty of time for most people to go get a booster shot, especially of the newly reformulated booster for the more current COVID-19 variants. The pandemic is not over. If we check the Washington State COVID dashboard, it shows that 69% of Washingtonians have been vaccinated, and I know we can do better than that. As of this week, there were about 7,300 new COVID cases per day, and that is probably a low count because it's relying on many people who are taking at-home COVID-19 tests to report the results of their positive tests to the state, which I'm guessing is not happening a lot of the time. There are about 450 people per day who are being hospitalized for severe COVID-19 symptoms in the state of Washington, and about 62 people are dying per day still here in our state from COVID-19. If we just look at here in King County, 82% of the population is vaccinated, which is good, but we really need to be above 90% to get real herd immunity. Okay. There are 2,430 new cases of COVID-19 in King County every day, That's just that's the numbers from this week. Okay. 68 people are being hospitalized every day just in King County. Okay. And 16 people are continuing to die every day in King County from severe COVID-19 symptoms. So the pandemic is not over.
Okay. No.
This week, the Biden administration announced the end of the federal program that provides free COVID-19 testing kits to anyone who wants to order them. But you can still get free kits through the Washington State Department of Health's Say Yes COVID Test Program. You can order them online, and here's the URL. It's all one long phrase, sayyescovidhometest.org.
Oh, that just rolls right off the tongue.
I know, and I'm gonna repeat that. I'm gonna repeat that. It's sayyescovidhometest.org.
And I'm sorry, we don't have any money for jingle singers anymore.
Yeah, and if that's too hard to remember, you can always Google free COVID test Washington State, and it should come up. Now, if you test positive with any home test kit, you should report the results to the State Department of Health. They have a Say Yes digital assistant, so we can keep that Washington COVID-19 dashboard up to date and not just be guessing what the state of the pandemic is in Washington State. But be prepared. People are already out gathering without masks in most places I've been to. And that is why COVID-19, people are still coming down with COVID-19, and so many people with a severe form. I mean, that's why the pandemic is continuing. But be prepared if you go out come October 31st, you're going to be the rare person with a mask, I think. Although there will still be, you should carry masks with you, because there will still be some businesses and some workplaces that are going to require you to wear a mask.
All right, let's move on. Developments this week with our former president.
Oh, yeah, it was another bad week for Donald Trump legally. Actually, it was a good week for him at the beginning of the week, because a Trump-appointed judge in South Florida ruled that Trump was entitled to a special master to be appointed by the court to review the Department of Justice's documents that it seized from Mar-a-Lago in early August to determine which ones might be protected by attorney-client privilege. And the DOJ had opposed this motion on the grounds that it had already done that review, but Judge Cannon ruled that a special master was necessary not only to review for attorney-client privilege, but also to review for executive privilege, which makes zero sense whatsoever, since, of course, Trump is no longer the president, and he did not declassify any of these documents while he was president, and does not have the authority to, subsequently. I mean, only President Biden can do that, and Biden's White House has already said that it waives executive privilege for any of the Trump documents. So a lot of legal scholars were kind of mystified by that ruling. The Department of Justice did appeal it yesterday, and they particularly appealed a part of the ruling that said that the DOJ could not use any of those documents in its criminal investigation of Trump. Now,
while they were undergoing the review by the special master.
Yes. And again, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, since, documents that are stamped, top secret or classified on every page would appear, pretty much prima facie to be, violations of the law, anytime they're taken out of, a secure location, which, boxes on the floor of Donald Trump's office are not a secure location. Spoiler alert. So that will continue to play out in the courts. We also saw Steve Bannon surrender to authorities in New York State this week. He has been charged under state law in New York, with the same thing that he pled guilty to and was subsequently pardoned by Trump for. His defrauding of Trump supporters for a charity he set up, charity being loosely defined, where he was raising money to privately build the border wall. Well, it turns out that the money was not going to build the border wall. It was going to fund Steve Bannon's lavish lifestyle. He was pardoned for that by Donald Trump, but he has been charged once again in New York State, and he surrendered to New York State authorities yesterday. So, once again, we're seeing that Trump surrounds himself with only the best people, and, you know, that's mostly the most high profile of a number of Trump associates who have been charged or convicted of various grifty schemes over the past couple of years. The DOJ also announced that it had convened a separate grand jury to investigate Trump's fundraising around the big lie, around that the election was stolen in 2020. He has raked in literally, I think, a couple of $100 million in fundraising, mostly from small donors, around the relentless barrage of emails that he has been sending out over the past couple of years, sometimes as many as a dozen a day, claiming that, you know, this is going to investigate election fraud, et cetera, et cetera. Only when you read the small print, you discover that Trump can really do anything he wants with those funds, including simply pocket them. And so the DOJ is investigating now whether that involves interstate wire fraud. So that's the update this week. He is in a world of legal trouble. This is in addition to civil cases that are pending against both Trump personally and the Trump Organization, and also the criminal case that is pending in the state of Georgia around election interference there in the year 2020. That investigation has continued to expand in Fulton County, which is where Atlanta is located, the state capital.
Moving on, a shooting this week in Memphis that was partly live streamed.
Yeah, a mass shooting in Memphis. This was on Wednesday, I believe, that killed four people and locked down much of the city, Tennessee's second largest city, for most of the day, as the shootings involved, in some cases, random people in cars. And again, this no longer even really much makes the national news because, you know, unless it's a double-digit body count, it doesn't seem to matter anymore. It really is kind of a sad commentary that, you know, something like this could happen in a major American city and it got very, very little attention outside the Mid-South. The suspect was eventually apprehended by police. I also read, this is in the category of police behaving badly, that U.S. Marshals shot and killed a pallbearer at a funeral for whom there was a warrant out. And witnesses, this is in northern West Virginia, and witnesses said that they opened fire without any warning whatsoever as he was literally carrying his father's casket to its grave. So naturally this horrified a lot of funeral attendees. And now they're burying a second member of the family. So, investigations are underway and I'm sure there will be a lot of accountability in that case as well. You know, it's another day ending in Y in America. That's very sad.
Moving on to international.
Well, no, we should talk about the heat dome.
Well, that kind of is a good segue then between national and international because, the whole planet is baking.
Yes. And heat domes don't really, respect international orders. Boundaries as we saw last year. Yeah.
Heat domes and forest fire smoke.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the news this week was that, the West Coast, or actually the western half of America, is experiencing its hottest September in history. Okay. Over 1,000 different heat records were broken in the first week of September all across the western United States, where much of the West was under triple digit temperatures, extremely unusual for September.
And a lot of California this past week had day after day after day where it was not just above 100, it was above 110.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same kind of heat dome that we had here a year ago, June.
Yeah, and not in July, August, but in September, which is very, very unusual. In addition, massive fires have erupted both in Northern and Southern California,
And in Southern and Central Oregon too.
There are fires currently burning in Oregon, Idaho, and Montana, which is why we are seeing fire, smoke headed our direction this weekend. But in the Northern California fire, there was another pyrocumulonimbus cloud event created by fire smoke. Something that's unusual, but also extremely unusual in September, especially since it was this fire in Northern California, the 23,000 acre mosquito fire, is more intense than the fires that I talked about just a couple of weeks ago that were burning in July, August. That in itself is really unusual. And then, of course, there's the second fire burning in Southern California, just about 75 miles southeast of Los Angeles, the Fairview Fire, which is also exhibiting some really, really intense levels of smoke and unusual fire behavior for September.
And Siskiyou County, which is a California county that borders Oregon in Northern California, has had 3 major wildfires this summer. It's remarkable.
Yeah, really remarkable. Now, as for the excessive heat warnings, 42 million people in the western United States were under excessive heat warnings in the first, 9 days of September. That includes Northern California, Northeast Arizona, Southern Nevada, much of Idaho, almost all of Montana, western Utah. The heat dome extended as far east as the Dakotas. Just an enormous area of the western United States. And like I said, there are wildfires that have erupted and are burning in places like Oregon, Idaho, Montana. I'm sure here in Washington State, we would have wildfires burning as well if the heat dome had extended as far north as us. We've escaped it for much of September until this weekend, and we'll see. Hopefully we'll skate by for a couple of days and before the cooler weather sets in, but just cross your fingers. But yeah, no, that is global warming.
Yeah, we're just getting on the edge of it on Saturday. Mm-hmm. But Friday and Sunday it will have moved on. So we'll largely escape the effects of it.
Yeah, and of course the mainstream media has kind of been reporting on it, but not really. not to the degree that they need to in order to make doing things to avoid further climate change as urgent as it really needs to be, right?
Yeah, a lot of those articles and newscasts don't even mention the words climate change.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even make the connection.
They just say, wow, this is amazing. It's outside of the norm. And then move on.
Yeah, and the weather, of course, weather is different from climate. We understand that at this point. And we understand that any particular weather event cannot be blamed directly on climate change. But we know that it's far more likely because of climate change. And people should be saying that.
Yeah.
That when you have 500-year weather events every summer, for example, that's climate change.
Yeah. So, for example, the Seattle Times reported on a study this week that came out that looked at 4 major climate tipping points and how close we were at what global temperatures those 4 tipping points would be triggered and how close we are to those. And the news actually in the study is that we're very close and that some of them may already have tipped over into those things inevitably happening, but we're at the point right now where we could slow that process somewhat. But if we continue business as usual, we're going to tip those very quickly. But even the Seattle Times and even larger mainstream press reporting on this, they don't take into account some of the very, very recent studies that show that actually our worst case scenarios for global warming are probably too conservative. And they report on these tipping points as, oh, well, you know, these glaciers will melt, but it's still a hundred year process, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, not necessarily.
You know, how about a 100-hour process?
You know, it's like you guys are, it's like they write these stories taking into account climate science that is 10 to 20 years old. Okay.
And we have not, seen now,
not
we have
the
seen
things
now for-
that, yeah, and not the things that they just reported on last week that show, for example, that the Thwaites Glacier, one of the what they call the Doomsday Glacier in Greenland, is actually melted much further than scientists predicted and is much, much closer to disappearing than they thought. You know? So it's almost as if there's this, you know, we'll report on this one week and then we'll forget all about it.
We have seen consistently for at least 20 years that the worst case scenarios of climate change prediction models are too conservative.
Yeah.
And that climate change continues to advance faster than the worst case scenarios, faster than we can revise what the worst case scenarios might be. And yet, you know, all that goes down that memory hole the next time we mention a worst case scenario.
Yeah, and then when they do talk about big events approaching and perhaps being triggered, they never really talk about how complex the entire system is and what the feedback loops may be. So, for example, in the most recent article I was just talking about these four major tipping points, they talk about they mention the thawing of permafrost, right? And they do mention, well, that could trigger a feedback loop. And then they move on and talk about how most of these things won't happen in our lifetime.
And we knew generations
down the road. And I'm like, no, likely not. You know, if the permafrost starts belching methane, that's not generations down the road. And that feedback loop is a big and important one. And if you're not going to talk about it, then you're really doing the human race a complete disservice and you're not doing your job as a journalist.
We have known for 30 years that the melting of permafrost would be catastrophic. And the big fear is that the vast regions of permafrost in Siberia, for example, those are already starting to melt. Permafrost is already melting in Alaska and in Arctic Canada. And, you know, there are already
signs that there's been methane released, you know, yeah. And there are already signs that process could be a big event, big explosive and potentially severe event once it starts happening on a much wider scale and not something that is generations down the road. So when I see that phrase or see these things framed that way in the media, I just have to say, you know, look, you can't be writing articles like this anymore. That's malfeasance as a journalist. You know, you have to at least look back over the past month at climate change stories and reframe your current article for what the current research is. Okay. And that's just not happening. And I just really find that to be alarming and upsetting. And it makes me mad. It does.
Yeah. Well, context is not a strong point of American media. We know.
Oh, no, it's not. And, but, you know, we can talk about how a lot of these media companies lack the resources, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's not that hard to do a Google search and just add a paragraph in your article. I just think that there are a lot of editors out there who cut that stuff out. And we have to point back to the editorial boards for these media companies and say, you guys are responsible. All right. And you gotta step up.
Yeah.
You know, well, and when you see articles like that, write to the, you know, respond to them, write to the editorial board and say, hey, this is not acceptable anymore.
Well, it's partly due to the way that our corporate media is structured when,
oh, yes.
when they're owned by the very, you know, same entities that are tight with the fossil fuel industry. You know?
Oh, yeah, and I was just talking about that with the Board of Regents at the UW.
Exactly.
There are a lot of media companies that function in the same way. You know, they survive because of advertising, not necessarily because of subscribers, but because of advertising, particularly online media. And advertisers don't like to place ads next to stories that bum people out, right?
Well, the
or that make them think, Why would I ever buy this product? Because it's leading us down the road to Armageddon.
The vast majority of Americans still get their news and information from television.
Mm-hmm.
That is the primary source, even more so than social media. And, you know, television is heavily reliant on fossil fuel advertising. I mean, the number of car porn ads that you turn on anytime you click into, cable news, for example. I mean, given the demographic, there's also a lot of big pharma ads, but, you know, the car porn ads are right up there. And of course, as you get into football season, that's all about beer and cars.
Trucks, yes.
And trucks and
some of the worst gas guzzlers and.
Yeah, and uh-huh. You know, the selling point of those vehicles is very rarely gasoline mileage or the fact that it's an electric vehicle. You know, the move to electric vehicles that has been fueled, no pun intended, over the last 5 years or so really has been driven by customer demand. And you see car makers moving to electric vehicles as fast as they can right now because they know that's where the new market will be. And if you've got states like California, setting the bar high by saying we're going to phase out electric, gasoline powered vehicles by, 2035. Which is, in terms of the timeline for developing vehicles, that's like right now for a lot of car makers. You're still not seeing that reflected in most ads. You know, you're still not seeing that as a major selling point. You're seeing the selling point being car culture and won't this make you look cool and won't you have these marvelous experiences in, places usually around the Four Corners region that you will never experience personally, but, you'll be able to climb straight up the side of that mesa in your new SUV. It's really, it's a real disconnect with where the market is going.
And I think before the show started today, I was complaining to Mike and Jav about how the way the mainstream media talks about climate change really allows people like Elon Musk, for example, to make really stupid statements where he was complaining that, the federal government pushing us to switch from fossil fuels to renewables was going to destroy the economy. And I'm like, what? Dude, your whole fortune is based off of people wanting to buy electric vehicles. What gives, And it's just that he is one of these wealthy people whose money is he's invested in the status quo, and anything that will change the status quo too much is a threat to his well-being is how he looks at it. So you have people like him making these outrageous comments because the mainstream media allows that to happen by the way they report on climate change.
Yeah,
they don't accurately and they don't keep up to date on the science. They don't accurately report on it.
No. And they're entirely lack again context.
Mm-hmm. And it just has to change. And you know, it'll only change if people push for it.
We hear about extreme weather events when they happen in the United States, but these are happening all over the world now, you know, routinely. I mean, we've had massive heat waves in Europe this year. We've got serious drought and heat waves going on in Asia.
Yeah, we have a large portion of the nation of Pakistan still underwater with
a third
of the entire country.
And parts of India
of
now.
People displaced. Yeah.
And parts of India now, too. It's spread. So, yeah, this has been very,
it has
a
been
very
a
grim year.
A
grim year.
A
grim year for extreme weather events.
Obviously, it's a subject we're going to be returning to regularly.
Oh, yes.
We got time, I think, to squeeze in one more somewhat related event. One of the things that climate change directly affects is the fact that nuclear power plants require large quantities of water to operate, and so those are all a threat. But in addition to that, the situation in Ukraine has their largest facility.
Yeah, a lot has been going on in Ukraine this past couple of weeks. We had a UN inspection agency visit the Zaporizhia. I'm not pronouncing that wrong, I'm sure. Zaporizhia.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the nuclear power plant on the Dnieper River in central Ukraine. That is the largest nuclear facility in Europe. And there's been fierce fighting going on around the plant for the last couple of weeks. This is part of a larger counteroffensive being waged by Ukraine, which has really seems to have made a sea change in the conflict in the last several days. The second largest city in Ukraine, Kharkiv, is on the verge of being liberated from Russian occupation after several months. The same for the key port of Kherson, which is at the mouth of the Dnieper River on the Black Sea. That's been held by Russia for several months. And Ukraine is reportedly on the verge of taking it over again. And Russia has been abandoning its weapons and, in some cases, its uniforms, Russian soldiers, that is, in large numbers over the past couple of days especially. There's been a lot of reports on Twitter of that. And it really looks like you know, the war of attrition might finally be moving toward Ukraine's favor. So that's something to keep an eye on, because that could be major, major news over the next week or so.
All right.
And yeah, the UN and the IAEA are warning that the fighting around the nuclear power plant is extremely dangerous. And they're concerned, as bureaucrats are, but, yeah, the potential for a serious nuclear accident is very high there right now.
They've called for a ceasefire around the plant, but neither of the two sides has been willing to actually do that. So,
Well, and it's partly because nuclear power plants require electricity, a large quantity of stable electricity to function, you know, to be able to do their thing. And that has been getting cut off regularly.
Yeah. And you can have generators, but generators require fuel. And currently that area is under an embargo. So getting fuel supplies in, it means that the plant really has to have consistent power from the grid. And the grid has been not reliable because of the shelling and because of the fighting in that area.
I can't remember exactly how many hundreds of nuclear reactors we have currently around the planet, but all those require water and electricity. And that ain't happening.
And a stable climate, you know, when you talk about weather disasters like floods and heat domes and wildfires and things like that, you have to think about what kind of infrastructure is in that area. Are there chemical plants? Are there nuclear power plants? You know, there are a lot of things that require stability. And when you start messing with the climate, changing the stability, you know, that can have these very, very serious consequences.
On that happy note, we are unfortunately out of time once again.
We'll be back next week, and we'll probably have more climate-related news. Just a guess.